and I'll just use her words here, to admit that women innately have power and authority within the kingdom of God and are not subservient imbeciles. Is that something we can do?
Reprehensible and subservient.
Ignorant and reprehensible, yeah. Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, April 29th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here, as always, with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent.
Great, Nick. Thanks.
So we all crowed about our Easter attendance last week. Time for some humility. Just how low did your low Sunday go?
Well, as low as it is, it was low Sunday, but like we've grown in the last two years, so our new low,
praise God,
pretty high. It was I've been thanking God for numbers like this like
right.
2 years ago. So, but it was low. It was like we had like we were missing like 30 people, 40 people. So.
We were able to put a baptism in sort of out of town.
Tricky.
Nice. One of the grandchildren of one of our members. And so that was an added bump, which was nice. So
we had
normal numbers, which was I was pleased. And again, like us, normal for us has been increasing in the past couple of years too. So it's fun to say.
Amen. I'm still with Matt. We were significantly lower than we were on Easter, but I would have been crowing last year. We were higher this year after Easter than we were. We were about Easter level last year. Wow. This year, the week after Easter.
So. I think it's the lowest. It's always lower when the Easter falls on like, no, I'm thinking of Christmas.
When Easter falls on a Sunday.
That's right. I'm thinking of Christmas. What am I doing? Can you delete that, please?
Never. That's going to be the cut. Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. today, we're going to do something quintessentially of the internet age. Are we going to make a claim? No. Are we going to respond to a claim? Of course not. We're going to respond to the response to a claim. So a few days ago, Ligon...
Isn't that very meta of us? You say?
Very meta, very internet.
It's very meta. That's right.
Ligon Duncan posted a congratulations to a female graduate of his seminary on her appointment to an editorship at Crossway. Reactions poured in, many seeming to suggest that what Duncan thought was a good thing was actually a bad thing. Some of the reasons being that a Christian man should be in that role, that this woman should never have gone to seminary in the first place, etc. Stand Firm's own Anne Kennedy has a piece up at her Substack. It's for paying subscribers right now, but maybe we'll put in a good word with the editor. Reacting to that, and she sees several prescriptions to fix the man-woman problem that evangelicalism is having right now. So guys, before we get to and react to Anne's prospective fixes, what in brief do you make of the issue as a whole for our listener?
Well, I found it's kind of disturbing we all on this podcast are hold to the complementarian view about women's relationships to men and marriage and in the church. But I mean, I think we've all, I've never seen it as a problem for a woman going on to get extra education. So,
right.
Like to be, I have no problem with women going and getting PhDs. And I think it's great, in fact, especially if it's in theology. I mean, you want women to know more about the Bible and know more about God and so that they'll be equipped to resist the various false teachings that are in our day specifically designed to appeal to women. So you want really well-trained, well-educated women who can handle those kinds of attacks. But apparently, I think there's a corner of the internet that corner of the X world and the corner of the Christian church, I guess, that thinks that is
it's like the first step to the road to perdition. Yeah,
exactly. Especially because, you know, if you go on to get a master's or a PhD, you more than likely are going to have a TA position, a teacher's assistant position at some point, and teach classes and that sort of thing. And so that one of the objections to this woman, a young woman who I know, by the way, is that she would have teaching authority over a man. And if she's an editor of a Crossway, she would also have authority over male authors. And then, like you said a minute ago, these jobs should be held by men and not women, because women should be home taking care of their children. And the whole thing, I think, avoids the idea. This person, Becca Davis is her name. She's not married. And being a single woman is a condition that's allowable, not only allowable, but in some sense encouraged by Paul in the New Testament. So what do you say to a woman who's single, celibate, wants to serve Christ, wants to serve the Lord? She can't stay home and eat, right? She has to get a job somewhere. So what does she do? And apparently she doesn't do anything. Maybe she can be a secretary or something. I don't know what the prescription would be on the really extreme. I don't want to use the word because I hate when people call me an extreme right person, but on the ad nauseum. Yeah. On the, I don't even know how to categorize this. It seems like a new type of patriarchalist.
Well, it seems like it's like a selective one too, because the first half of Paul's admonition that a woman should learn with all submissiveness is that she should learn.
Yeah.
And certainly he has ways in which she should learn. But Lydia, it seems like the Proverbs 31 woman is some kind of entrepreneur. There doesn't seem to be, even if a woman was married, as long as she's not abandoning her household responsibilities, which St. Paul does seem to be clear about, that there are responsibilities at home. As long as those are not abandoned or shunted aside, it doesn't seem like work is restricted from her. And certainly it seems like Paul would want women to be as educated in the faith as they could be. The thing that I keep seeing on X is the idea that seminary ought to be for pastors. And so we need to be sort of closing off seminary education to people who are not called to the pastorate, to headship in the church.
Yeah, and I agree. Maybe 100 years ago or so, seminaries were exclusively for people training for the pastorate. But what, for the last, mid 20th century, they started expanding their degrees so that you can go to seminary, a quote unquote seminary, and get a master's in theological studies or
master of arts and religion. Yeah,
right. Master of arts and religion. You're not clearly going to be ordained. I mean, it seems like a kind of a pedantic argument to say, well, if you're going to call yourself a seminary, you can only train men for ordained ministry. Well, why? Where does that law come from? I understand that only men should be training for ordained ministry, but I don't think that necessarily means that an organization that calls itself a seminary must only do that thing. And so I asked this one guy on Twitter, I said, well, would you object to a non-seminary school offering master's and PhD degree programs for lay people, both men and women, as long as they don't call themselves a seminary? Oh yeah, that's fine. What?
Yeah, that was a little
really pedantic.
Well, I agree. I mean, I agree with you, Matt, and I thought it was a good defense of, I think a more sane position. But I do appreciate, I don't want to defend the original poster exactly, but I do think that they are noticing a sort of a general drift, particularly in these reformed, conservative reformed denominations. They're hypersensitive to a drift towards, denominational positions of more of like what we were, came out of. And so I think that, with any sort of reaction and sort of hypervigilance, there can be overreactions. And I think we might have observed one there, because the conversation itself is really interesting. When you look at the generation of women that were told, you should prioritize career and sort of autonomy over, motherhood and being a wife and a mother. This was, celebrated for generations, and then all of a sudden, you have this large cohort of unhappily unmarried, otherwise worldly successful women. And so, there's a real question there. How do you balance the two? It's not like you can't be the CEO of a company and a stay-at-home mom. You can't be. There's some, always going to be some trade-offs. That being said, I think this particular issue with respect to education is, laughable. I mean, I think almost, I think it's because if anything, like I'm looking at my wife, she has a master's from Trinity, MAR, and she's putting that to great use, in part by educating our own children. Now, if we were sending them to school, it still wouldn't want a less educated wife to converse with and to, to read my sermons and to, correct me when necessary. Lovingly, she just lets me over there. But and so, I think that, but I do think the broader conversation, it's interesting how all the various reactions. I mean, I think I was grateful that you had, personal experience with this woman and her family and was able to sort of read it through that lens. That being said, I would not have agreed with the original poster, but I do appreciate the broader conversation and the fact that it's taking place, however imperfectly, is still a positive in my opinion. I mean, I think Anne's reaction to it was one of the best things she's written. And that's saying a lot because she writes great, but I thought her reaction to it, furthered the conversation and even for me personally in a way that I'm grateful for. And that wouldn't have happened had he not, we didn't have X and we weren't able to say sometimes ridiculous things and provoke all these people. So, I think, but I do think we're entering into, this broader conversation that I'm thankful that more people are engaging with, not just Christians, because the real question of, what is a woman after the pill, remains first and foremost. And of course, we just heard that medical study that Al was talking about this morning that came out that talked about,
the other pill.
Turns out you kill a living organism within your body that has negative physical effects on you as well, And so but all of these conversations are part of a whole. And I think that we are in this missional moment, to use the catchphrase, that where we have something clear and non-reactionary and stable to provide for young men and women is going to speak volumes. And it continues to, and I think, and also a rational way of both encouraging young women to pursue their educational opportunities and yet also, remain open to the possibility of becoming a wife and mother. I mean, that's what I want for my daughters. And those are the type of women that I'm hoping my boys will be, drawn to. So, yeah, I thought the way you handled that and the way you clarified it was very, very helpful, Matt.
I think it's totally fair to ask a godly woman who wants to seek higher education in theological matters to consider that as talented in those realms as she may and hopefully will honestly find herself, to be aware that there are roles that will be outside the scope of her calling. No matter how good she is at the schooling part, she can't look at her male counterpart in the classroom and say, well, I'm better than this guy and he's going to be a pastor, so I should be too. It's one thing to be talented. It's another thing to be submissive to the word of the Lord.
Yeah. I mean, God is very impractical. I mean, he doesn't look around for who has the best skill at this particular task and pick that person, or he wouldn't have picked half the disciples he picked when he was incarnate, right? Peter, he's going to be awesome.
Or at least one of the people on this very podcast.
So yeah, absolutely. But I think one of the issues, and Anne kind of gets at this in her piece, is that there's nothing else but being a pastor that's seen as having a honor and authority and importance in the church. I'm not saying there's nothing.
That's right.
In a lot of churches, that's the way it is. The pastor is the man, and
the one doing the ministry.
Exactly, and everyone else is kind of sitting at his feet. Yeah. And so, if there were other venues or avenues for women to serve that conveyed honor, conveyed authority in a certain aspect of it, I think there wouldn't be this like push to, I've got to be pastor. I've got to be pastor. But when you leave just that avenue, just that position as the highest position available, and then say to women, you can't get into it, I can see why, just from a human standpoint, that would be very, very hard, a very hard thing to hear. I'm not saying you have to say it. But the church has to, there wasn't this problem in the Middle Ages because there was a pretty thriving monastic vocation. A woman could go, a woman could be a sister or then an abbess. And abbesses had a lot of power in the Middle Ages. They had a lot of authority under their bishops, and they weren't priests, but they had influence and authority. There's nothing like that in the church, at least in the Protestant realm.
Except in practice, as you've mentioned many times, almost any church you see on the street has a very right. powerful woman who's running yes. almost everything.
Very often.
But go ahead. Well, I think this is, you know, it's all part of a whole, and it just keeps reminding me of Mary Aberstadt's book about how the West really lost God, if you remember that book. And she talks about faith and family as being like a double helix, you know, and like without one, you lose the other. And I'm just, as you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, the normative pattern for human relation, male, female, was in Christian West was marriage, because most people aren't celibates. And in order to exercise your non-celibate life, you had to get married, right? And then the fruit of that non-celibacy, the consensual monogamy, would be a child. And so you immediately had the structure that necessitated this breakdown of familial roles. And more than that, you actually were taught about just what the limits of a father were and the power of a mother and vice versa, you know, because if you grew up in a home with multiple children and watched what the father had to do to actually provide for and sacrifice for the sake of his family, you may not want that role. You know, you may not actually aspire to it if you're a woman, or you might be even nervous about it if you were a boy, you know, which is part of the training process, and vice versa. You know, if you have a wife and you have a mother for that matter, then you realize that there are a lot of ways power can be exercised without it being direct and official, you know. And so, I mean, the history of, you know, the Western literature is full of incredibly powerful women, sort of actors who, you know, may technically have not had any official power and yet, you know, moved mountains and created worlds. And so, you know, I think that's part of the contemporary problem, is that we have this sort of societal breakdown at a real level. You know, at every socioeconomic level is awash with broken marriages and, you know, sort of broken, dysfunctional families, and the products of all that go into church and sort of have a unhealthy view of men and women from the beginning. And I think, you know, again, I'm not saying specific people, and I know that there are exceptions to all these rules, all these statements, but that being said, there's a general misunderstanding between men and women that is in part because the normative way that we were intended to interact intimately as adults has been disrupted in such a powerful way. And I don't really know the answer to that, other than to, like Anne mentions in her piece, like start reconsidering, you know, hormonal birth control, like start speaking more openly about the good of marriage, you know, encouraging younger people, you know, this idea that you got married young, too young, is just it's so often said because it's the only defense mechanism so many people have for having a divorce in their past. But it's just, it couldn't be further from the truth. You know, it's like Brad Wilcox says, you know, marriage used to be seen as the foundation and now it's the capstone. It's like, well, you know, how high is your pillar going to be before you finally put a capstone on it, you know? And that's what people are just beginning to reconsider. So I don't know. I'm again, I sound like a broken record. I'm excited because the problems are forcing a rethink. And I think that, that obviously in any rethink, there are going to be overreactions, but at least the thoughts and conversations are being had. And thankfully we don't have to rewrite the script. I'm encouraged by this, the direction this conversation is going.
So do you want to ruthlessly fisk Anne's suggested yes. suggestions to fix this problem?
I love my wife and she's a great writer, much better than I am. She has some great, so she wrote an article about this whole topic, and she had some suggestions about some ways to fix it. And I guess it's toward the end of her article, but maybe we could just focus on those.
Sure.
Because it's kind of a large article, a long article. The first, she says, you know, stop talking quite so much about it. God, I'm not sure that I agree with her on this, but the constant outrage drowns out the real life situations in which men and women are getting along with each other just fine. But I'm, like I said, I don't totally agree with her about the not talking about it so much, but I do think that she's right about the constant outrage.
Let me interpret what I think.
Okay.
And you know her far better than I do. Probably have a clearer idea of what she's shooting at here. But when I read that, what I read as stop picking out the egregious examples as emblematic of the whole, finding the one mean complementarian online, and therefore assuming that every church that organizes itself according to those biblical principles must be abusive. And we know, even the research shows, that complementarian husbands who go to church are the least abusive of any group. Obviously, ones who do not go to church, they're off the reservation. But when she says constant outrage drowns out the real life situations in which men and women are getting along with each other just fine, most of that is in these churches seeking to be faithful to biblical instructions about how men and women ought to relate. Those are the men and women who are getting along best.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think, you know, maybe a great example of it is just this particular controversy. I mean, picking Becca Davis out of all the women to get upset about. I mean, I'm sure that the people who know her and are in relationship with her, they don't think of her as like a feminist or like, you know, pushing herself forward to get into a position that a man should have. She's just not like that. And anyone who knows her and reads the tweets about her is just saying, this is so ridiculous. But it is. Now it's become this outrage generating machine. And so yeah, I can see that being the case. I don't see how you stop that though. Isn't that just the nature of
Well, I think basically saying like turn off the internet.
Right.
Yeah. But I think the answer to it is what we're, you know, however imperfectly attempting to embody and to actually produce. I mean, not just like the conference that we just had down here. Like the arguing about it is different than presenting a more beautiful way, you know. And I think that's really what I've come to is that, like, yes, there are going to continue to be egregious examples in our denomination, across denominations, of people in, you know, out of order situations with respect to men and women, and that's just going to be the case, and, you know, insofar as it goes at the moment. So what do we do about that? You know, we could sit around and just complain about it all the time, or we could, you know, and sometimes we have pointed out when it's, you know, like a priest saying something or maybe a bishop, but for the most part, all we can really do is build on the foundation that we've been given in our own context and do the best we can to, like I said before, quoting Paul, to show a more beautiful way, you know, because it's like when I used to talk, people used to ask me about same-sex, quote-unquote, marriage, you know, and I said, well, look, you know, the world has a pretty good idea of what actual Christians think about this, you know, so you don't really have to spend a lot of time. If someone comes to you and says, you know, defend this position, it's like, well, that's, I can do that. But what I'm more interested in a certain sense, is to build up the actual positive case for why God has said this for men and women. And, you know, it doesn't mean that it certainly has negative implications for, or at least it has limits, but those limits are in the service of a good and beautiful thing, which is ultimately true. And so that's where we are with respect to this entire question, is that, you know, there are going to be, you know, think about like the unfortunately single mother who has to get a job and, you know, and finds herself in a situation she wishes she may not be in. It might not fit, you know, the biblical structures. And you could point that out and say, see, you know, our whole culture is going to hell in a handbasket. Or you could just say, you know, well, that's out of order in a certain sense, but, you know, goodness, you know, people have to do what they have to do to feed themselves and the people that they're responsible for. But there is a more beautiful sort of structure that we could aspire to. It's not like talking to a single person, you know, an unhappily single Christian. You know, you don't have to bless them in that state. You can mourn with them, recognizing that they may stay forever, and that it's not the ideal. And yet it will be ultimately redeemed, you know, in the eschaton. But until then, we may have to just stumble along. But I do think that the presenting the positive view and in a sort of unapologetic and gentle yet convicted way is going to be the way forward. I wish they would do that at seminaries. You know, I wish Trinity and Neshota, for that matter, who connect to ACNA, would just simply teach both positions, you know, the best steel man, as it were, both of the positions, as faithfully and as gently and as honestly as they can. And I think that over time, you would start seeing people be persuaded by the goodness of this differentiation and complementarianism, as opposed to either confused by it or angered by it. And I think that's like the first conversation you and I ever even had, Matt, like 10 years ago now or something. And down in South Carolina, down in St. Christopher's, because we were like, let's make a seminary curriculum where literally the final paper was like a 50-page original language, historical, exegetical paper on men and women. And by the time you could do that, I think that the scriptures would have convinced you by the spirit of the more good and beautiful way.
Well, in service of that more good and beautiful way, Han asks people on both sides in her points 2 and 3 to sacrifice something. She asks the pro women's ordination folks to give that up for the sake of the body in point number 2. And she asks in point number 3 for those like us who are against the ordination of women to, and I'll just use her words here, to admit that women innately have power and authority within the kingdom of God and are not subservient imbeciles. Is that something we can do?
Reprehensible and subservient.
Ignorant and reprehensible, yeah.
Well, that is something that's a little bit more difficult, it seems, for some than others. Like, I'm trust, and I ask Liza all the time to please, you know, help me not slide into a strident or a sort of dismissive tone in all these discussions. And, you know, so far, so good. I mean, she listens to everything I put up, in part because of that. You know, I mean, not just that issue, but in general. But I do think there has been some, and I am thinking in particular, you know, some of these Facebook interactions, some of these Twitter interactions with respect to this question have veered very close, if not over the line, of just being outright unchristian, or at least uncharitable to a large degree, you know, and sort of seemingly actually misogynistic, like they really do think women are just imbeciles or something. And it's like, I don't know what your relationship to your wife or mother is like, but you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say that that's prevalent. I don't think it's prevalent, but I have been surprised in some of these forums at times, and even on Twitter, you know, and usually it's an anonymous account or something, but there has been some real snark, I think you could say, with respect to just women in general. And, you know, and then dismissing people who are ordained, you know, just out of hand, as if there was some sort of, you know, like there wasn't anything positive about them as a person at all. And I think that's unfortunate. And I don't think it does anyone any good, and particularly doesn't help the conversation take place in any helpful way. And I think, you know, I think we've, I'd like to think we've done a good job of talking about it as respectfully as we can, but I'm trying to be sensitive to like the fact that you know, that there are people that we care about who have been ordained or are ordained and are serving even in various churches. And, you know, we can disagree. I mean, I'm thinking of one person in particular as a dear friend, and we have a sincere disagreement on this. And yet I hope that there is still a sense of common cause and shared gospel ministry, despite the fact that, you know, I do think that there's some disorder there. But
yeah, this is, I mean, it's a really important point, because I think there are two types of ordained women, right, and two types of women who are for women's ordination. The first is the one that we typically use as representative of the whole, the feminist who just wants to, you know, I can do anything a man can do and better kind of person. Who takes the trajectory argument, I guess, from the New Testament.
That's catchy. Well, you should write a song to that.
Right. It's an Annie Get Your Gun Already.
Yeah. But then there are others who like grew up in the Episcopal Church. They believe the Bible. They're Orthodox. They grew up in like maybe an Orthodox area of the Episcopal Church. In their lives, they had only known of women being ordained. They hadn't
That's
known
right.
of any other way. And so the sexuality thing comes along. They're against the LGBTQ movement. They believe their Bible. They're maybe even in the process of being ordained. They get ordained. They stand against this thing. They join the ACNA, and then they find themselves in a position where, oh wait, there's a whole half of my church thinks I
That's
should.
Right.
I should. So a lot of women have given up a lot. A lot of people, women who have been ordained, have given up a lot for the sake of the gospel. And those are the women I think who should be treated much.
That's right.
Different.
And that represents basically every woman that's been ordained through Trinity in the past 20 years. You know, like you didn't go to Trinity to get Episcopal fame and fortune, you know. And I'm very sympathetic to that. And there's women in our diocese, for that matter, who are ordained. And I think that's the challenge. You know, the challenge is how do we have the conversation that has, you know, in our opinion, fairly black and white resolution here, while still maintaining relationship and hopefully goodwill despite these disagreements. It's a challenge. You know, we're to our listener out there who thinks that we're failing. I apologize, but I think that it seems to be the case that the you know, the more that you exercise these muscles in a loving, you know, gentle and humble way, as 1 Peter 3 would say, that we are defending this in part, this conviction, the more that muscles are exercised, the more you sort of get the words behind you, the more you articulate it, then the easier it gets to be to hold in this tension. And that's what I've personally experienced. And that's what I'm continuing. That's why we continue to talk about it in part, because, you know, the experience that I had in the Episcopal Church was that if you held your own convictions silently, or at least weren't able to publicly articulate them in any meaningful way, particularly as a rector, well, then you begin to lose them, or at least they begin to weaken. You know, yeah. It's like Romans 10, you know, if you believe in your heart that Jesus rose from the dead and confess with your mouth that he is Lord, you'll be saved. You know, it's not if I sit by in the back looking across the room at the girl for the entire dance and never make a move, you know, did I really love her, you know, sort of thing, or did I really, you know, so I feel like there's a necessity to this that's going to be messy. And I hope, like with you, Matt, I hope that there's an appreciation for some of the ordained women, particularly in the ACNA, and what they have sacrificed, that will at least temper the vitriol, while at the same time still recognizing that I think the conversation needs to be had.
So her fourth and fifth points are also related. She wants us to de-emphasize the status of the pastor, something he can do himself, by neither being supercilious nor domineering, but just a normal person. I once told a search committee when they asked me what my spiritual gifts were, that my spiritual gift was that I was a normal person, and I had the job offer in my email before I got home from the interview. her point number five related, you Bud Light the concept of the celebrity pastor. I'm not sure how
Did
I feel about this
that?
Being
Did
a celebrity
she?
Pastor. This is hard for me, but they do seem to be related points.
Did she come up with is that an Ann?
I think she made that up, yeah.
Apex legomenon there, that's right. So she's a Bud Light. So she means cancel it, right?
Yeah.
right.
So it's a...
Well, because, you know, in our culture, everyone is a celebrity, right? And if you have, and if in the church, maybe not so much in the Anglican world, but in the evangelical world, you know, the guy up there, the light's shining on him, you know, he's got the skinny jeans and the...
I can't even walk down the streets in Louisville these days. I'm mobbed all the time.
Yeah, I know. It must be hard for you, Nick. But then it begins. Not only is it the case that in a lot of churches the pastor is the one who has the power, but also the glamour that goes along with it in some churches, in some denominations, or some non-denominational settings, the glamour that goes with the pastor is exactly what it mirrors the glamour of our culture. Mm-hmm. And so, so having a man up there with all the light shining on him and he's the star, right? He's the big deal. And then saying, oh, but women can't do this. That you know, that it just seems very, you've already departed from the Bible in so many ways at that point by having a celebrity pastor. Yeah. So deep six that idea.
Bud Light it.
Bud Light it. I'm sorry. Yeah. Bud Light it and get back to what a pastor actually is. And then if you get back to what a pastor actually is, according to the Bible, then maybe the role distinctions will make more sense.
Well, if you look at where Paul says, you know, that as God is the head of Christ, Christ the head of man, that man is the head of the woman, but the woman is the glory of man, right? So if you're looking analogously to the bride, the church, and the man, you know, the father of the family there, you know, the glory of the glory should not be the pastor. You know, the glory is the work of the church in and through the lives of her people, you know? And so I think, I mean, that's maybe not exactly analogous to what Paul meant, but I was just thinking that through as you were speaking, because there really is something out of line when the pastor is seen as the celebrity in any capacity, as opposed to the leader, you know, perhaps, you know, it doesn't have to be like a doormat or something, you know, the shepherd, the protectorate, the defender of the faith. I mean, those are all appropriate, but actually sort of like famous and flashy, you know. We were actually talking about that at staff meeting today about, we had an interesting discussion about black clergy shirts versus my more colorful ones. And the argument was that I was sort of, I was transgressing the purpose behind the uniform, which was to de-emphasize the personality of the priest to the, you know, sort of magnify the office. And I said, well, you know, I agree to that to a certain extent, which is why on Sundays I'm very formal and very uniform, you know, but throughout the week I take a little liberty. But the point was well taken, which is that, you know, there are pastors who are known, as we know, for their fabulously expensive, you know, cutting edge fashion show every single Sunday. And I can't even imagine what's going on in their minds in that respect. I mean, I don't know if it's just been so far removed from that, or it's just been a work of the spirit or both, but like, it just seems so incredibly foreign to an understanding of church and the pastorate that, you know, it's almost two different, I don't want to say two different religions, but it almost seems, of course, if you looked just without the sound on, you might think it was.
We say in every membership class that every member is a minister. And I'm sure your churches are like mine, in which if everybody in the laity stopped doing ministry, the church would grind to a halt immediately. We'd have Sunday service, perhaps, but it would be quiet and we'd do almost nothing else.
I'll be sitting on the floor.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I love the way that she brought it back. I mean, I love Mary Harrington has helped refocus all of our lives against birth control. But, you know, her final point about getting rid of hormonal birth control, I mean, that I really think that that will, I mean, I'm not alone in this, but will have gone down to being one of the most consequential sort of societal disruptors in the history of in human history. I mean, I think that's almost safe to say, you know, like right, probably above the wheel and above the printing press, you know, and even the internet, because it's so, so fundamentally disrupted any sane conversation between men and women by, you know, sidelining one of the major functions of their rapprochement for, or whatever. Anyway, don't cut that out.
That's great. I love it.
Like, it's like Alex Trebek, you know, every time he said a foreign word, he'd be like, 100 Years of Solitude, written by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, but sort of, anyway. Anyway, but no, I think I really don't. I mean, Ivan, and we've talked about this, like, you know, Laza and I were not convicted about this early on in our marriage. And, you know, it's been a journey through that. And, you know, you always wonder, well, what effects could that have had or didn't have? And, you know, just sort of the, I mean, it's literally in the water, you know, hormone birth control, and the idea that it is not fundamentally reshaping our conceptions of human relation is false. And so I think, you know, as fathers, as pastors, as people that are teaching, I think that there's a very countercultural and often seemingly offensive, but nevertheless true thing to say, which is that you should seriously reconsider your use of birth control and certainly some of these abortive fashion ones that that actually kill the babies, you know, at the very least. And, you know, it's again, we talked about it all the time. If you told me 10 years ago, I've been saying that out loud, thinking it, much less saying out loud, or if 20 years ago, I would have said, like, what? What's happened? But well, here we are. But, you know, I think that's where it's, you know, it's all, again, all part of this incredible challenge that we have, is that we're trying to recreate a sane, healthy, and I want to say safe, God glorifying world within an incredibly hostile, crazy environment, really, in some cases. And that's just no small thing. You know, I mean, someone recommended me the other day that I should just reread After Virtue and Benedict Option, like on repeat, and just keep, you know, reminding of like the world we're inhabiting, both intellectually after Virtue, and then also the world that we have to create within this new world, namely with the Benedict Option. And I sort of smiled and then went back and found my copies and start rereading, because I think that's what the church is going to become. Like, that's what we're in its ideal form. You know, we're going to go back to a certain degree where we, you know, we reconsider travel baseball, you know, reconsider hormonal birth control, reconsider climbing the corporate ladder, men and women, you know, and actually getting some chickens, you know, and maybe going to church every other night, you know, who knows? I mean, but like, what is happening, what is given to the world as good is being exposed in every capacity as a lie, you know, and some people are too far in that they're able to not admit it. They're not able to admit it. And some people are just starting to wake up to it, you know? And so I think we have to be ready for, we have to be ready for welcoming these people and have something to equip them with. And I think that's where, you know, I'm by God's grace, feel like we've been up to the challenge. And I think, I'm just expecting it to get more and more prevalent as we go forward.
We are near the end of our time. Any final thoughts, you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't want to get. I did want to say something about what JD just said, and that's that, you know, in the 90s, I remember listening to Christian radio, and like one of the distinctions between Roman Catholics and the Protestants was, well, we can use birth control because there's nothing in the Bible that says we can't, right? And I remember even listening to one guy talk about the sin of Onan. It's not really birth control, whatever. But this goes to show, I mean, I think the dearth of appreciation for natural theology in Protestantism is problematic, and we're beginning to see why that's the case. You have to recognize that God made the world with purposes. And even if the Bible doesn't directly address something, we can definitively say the reason God made men with the organs they have and women with the organs they have is so that they can have babies. And then he did institute marriage for the raising of godly children, godly offspring. So, you know, while there might not be an explicit biblical command against birth control, clearly you're stepping in the way of right. something that God has intended for men and women in marriage to do. So I think, what was it, 1930, the Anglican, the church?
We were one of the first ones.
The first ones to do it. So yeah. I don't know if it's possible, but I would love to see the ACNA revisit that.
Boy, that would be, there's
a contentious
end on a crescendo there. So you've heard it.
The mailbag will be full next week.
Soon to be canon. Well, I think if you, at the very least, we do address it indirectly by swearing to uphold life from conception to natural death. Mm-hmm. So that means at the very least, we're taking a lot of what is considered quote unquote birth control off the table, at least convictionally. So, I think it's going to be wild. I read an article the other day, and Unheard, I think, it was a woman. She must have been around my age because she had all the same cultural reference from the late 80s and 90s. But she was talking about how she was saying, and this is sort of laughable, I think, that because there was such a prevalence of anti-teenage pregnancy messaging in the 80s and 90s, that basically the natal cliff that we've gone off of, you know, the fact the low birth rate is just because we actually listened. That was her argument. That's it. Yeah. And I was like, right, we listened. And then I just read that Mitha Prestone, or listened to the results, and it said since 2017, 865,000+ cases of Mitha Prestone, they have this recorded because they were all prescriptions. And so the 865,+ prescriptions written for mifepristone since 2017, you know, that might have more to do with the lack of children than the after school messaging from, you know, Saved by the Bell or whatever. So, but I think, I could say more, but I think we got to cut off, right, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very awkward end to a podcast.
Sorry, I should have ended it up, but I didn't want to say that.
It's not much more to say. What else should we rethink? What else should the bishops reconsider, Matt?
Well, that is going to be all the time that we have this week. Thank you for listening to Stand Firm. If you want to keep the conversation going, please be in touch with us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. Follow us on social media. Join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.